and welcome to Mountain Money. My name is Allison Kulo. Today is Monday and Memorial Day. We've put together a special show for you today, and we're going to start with an interview that Roger Goldman and I recorded with Jessica Strong. Jessica Strong is with Blue Star Families, an organization dedicated to supporting current and former military families. We'll then go back to an interview that Doug Wells and Roger Goldman recorded in January. This interview is with Tim Mack. Tim Mack is an NPR Washington investigative correspondent who reveals the corruption and ongoing downfall of the NRA in his new book, Misfire, Inside the Downfall of the NRA. Over the past week, many have been referencing this book with relation to the school shooting. We had the opportunity to talk with Tim and have him share his thoughts and his findings. All this and more on Mountain Money. All of us are keenly aware that today is Memorial Day, a day to honor our military dead that is also effectively the unofficial start of summer. As a nation, we are less aware that since 1999, the entire month of May has been designated by Congress as Military Appreciation Month.
For many years now, the military has been an all-volunteer force. As a result, many Americans have little direct contact with those who have made the sacrifice to serve. And the military life is not an easy one, not just for those in uniform, but for their entire families. On this Memorial Day, we are lucky to have had the opportunity to record an interview with Jessica Strong of Blue Star Families, an organization dedicated to supporting current and former military families. Good morning, Jessica, and thanks for joining us.
I am so excited to be here. Thank you for having me today.
Jessica, let's start. Before we get into some of the things that Blue Star Families has found out about the lives of military families, let's start with a little bit about Blue Star Families itself. When was it formed and what's its mission?
The Blue Star Families was formed in 2009 by a group of military spouses who got together and said, listen, we love serving our country. We love being part of the military lifestyle, but there has to be a way to make this easier. There has to be a way to address some of the challenges that we're experiencing as part of a military family. So what they did is the first thing they did is look at, if we're going to advocate for this population, if we're going to create programs that support military families, we need to know what the issues are. So they created the first military family lifestyle survey. And we have been doing this annually ever since. It's a comprehensive survey of military connected individuals. So you could be active duty, National Guard, Reserve, veteran, or retired service member, or a spouse, and take the survey to tell us about what the major issues are and how can we help solve these problems. And that is actually fielding right now.
Oh, the 2022 survey is out in the field right now.
2022 is open at the moment.
And it's interesting to me that Blue Star saw a gap, if you will, from some of the kinds of things that one would have hoped that the various government entities would have stepped into. Let's talk about what those surveys are finding. In particular, let's talk about some of the more significant findings from last year. I want to start with housing. Talk a little bit about military housing.
Yeah, military housing has been, it is one of the issues that impacts a lot of military families. Now, the majority of military families no longer live on military installations. The majority live out in the communities, which is one of the things that Blue Star Families is aware of and is looking to address. One of our major missions is to connect military families with the communities in which they live. They often live in civilian communities, have civilian neighbors that don't know much about military service. So we're trying to connect and build bridges of belonging between the military families and the communities that they live in. But some do live in on installations in military communities. And so we want to address their housing there, the wait list for housing in some places. Particularly in the past year, we've seen a significant increase in housing markets in near military installations. So if families are living off the installation in the civilian community, often their basic allowance for housing, that the stipend that they receive in order to obtain housing not on the installation, is not in keeping with the market rates in the community in which they live. So first, we've had a huge shift in the housing market where the costs are skyrocketing for families. And then we've also seen at the same time a decrease in the proportion of the housing that their stipends is intended to cover. It used to be intended to cover 100% of housing costs for that family. And they decreased that to 95%. So they're expecting military families to have some out-of-pocket housing costs. What we found last year in our survey, though, is that the vast majority, almost three quarters of our military families who have out-of-pocket housing costs are spending well over what the intended amount is. So the DoD predicted that the intended amount to spend out-of-pocket would be somewhere between $58, $158, somewhere around there. That's supposed to be your out-of-pocket cost. But three quarters of our families are spending more than $200 a month, every month, on out-of-pocket housing costs. So we're well over what the anticipated amount should be.
You talked about active military with regards to housing, but do you do any kind of surveying with regards to veterans and their housing situations?
So we do survey veterans. We don't tend to focus on housing there because they're not getting a VAH. They're not living on military installations. But what we do hear from our veteran respondents about financial security, when we ask about financial stressors, are some of the things that stress veteran and retired families financially are major home repairs. So you can imagine they may have been living in their home in their community for a while, and now they have to replace a roof, replace an HVAC unit, or do those major home repairs, which can be a significant financial stressor for families.
As I mentioned, I grew up on the edge of a military base, and one of the things that we saw was that every year or two, the family that lived down the street would disappear, and another military family would come in. But that was in an era when single employee families were common. In other words, the husband typically would be the military server or officer, and the wife would not work at all. But that's not the way American society is. And how is it that spousal employment is presenting itself as an issue for military families?
Spouse employment is one of the top issues, if not the top issue, that we see year after year in the survey. We know that it's a major concern, especially for families who are relocating. If the spouse is employed, every time you relocate, you leave your job behind and then you start over at the next place. So, and when you start over, you may not start at the same level at which you left. You may go from a high level position to something else. Just briefly telling you about my own experience, I was an assistant professor at one duty station. And when we PCS'd, the next job that was available was a tutor for high school kids. So not the same level of employment. And you have to start over each time. So what we see there is their relocation is a barrier to employment for military spouses. But in addition to that, it's also finding childcare and balancing the service member's day-to-day job demands. For the service member, the military service comes first, as it should. That's the commitment that they've made. What that means, though, is whenever there is some flexibility required to manage household obligations or childcare needs, that consistently falls to the spouse because they have to be the flexible one. So if you need to have that HVAC unit repaired and you have to wait at home for the repairman who may be there, you know, sometime between 8 in the morning and 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the spouse is the one that's often doing that because the service member can't. So we see spouses not only are unemployed because they're relocating or they can't find childcare that will accommodate some of the flexibility that they need, or they are stepping out of the labor force. It is too difficult to try and balance everything you need to do for household and childcare and moving with employment. So we see lower labor participation rates for spouses, and we also see more unemployment. But one of the things that Blue Star Families does is we not only have a careers program where we try to help spouses get to employment, but we also advocate and share this information that we're learning and the data that we pick up from the survey with legislators, with decision makers who can help make policy changes to address these issues.
There have been stories in the press about food insecurity for military families, and it's something very hard to believe. Are there really military families on food stamps or in need of food pantries? And if so, why is it happening?
So this is tied to the last question. It is often tied to spouse employment. What we found in our survey last year is that spouses who were employed, families who had a spouse who was employed, had a much lower rate of food insecurity than families who had a spouse who was not employed. And again, it has to do with the barriers with affordable childcare, accessible childcare, available childcare, and the type of jobs that you're able to get when you are moving from one place to another pretty consistently. We did see on food insecurity in military families. In fact, 14% of our active duty respondents of color reported low or very low food insecurity. So we know not only is it an employment issue, it is also an issue that is often tied to race or ethnicity. So 14% of our respondents of color reported low or very low food security compared to only about 7% of their white, not Hispanic counterparts, which is one reason, one of many reasons, but one reason that Blue Star Families launched this campaign for inclusion, where we address issues of race and diversity in military families and how race and ethnicity impacts military service and vice versa.
You know, for a number of years, the military has been known as an area with sort of better racial relationships, better racial equality. Talk to us a little bit about how military families perceive that issue. How do active duty families feel about discrimination within the military?
I mean, I had the same impression when I first looked at this issue. I was like, the military has been known as this, you know, it's a meritorious system, right? It's based on merit. They don't see color. But that actually can be, what we've learned from our research is that actually can be sort of a harmful perception that if you don't see color, you also don't see some of the issues that we face. We know many of our military families of color in the research that we're doing have said, we are making our family decisions about what duty station we're going to next. We're sitting around the kitchen table and talking about what are our options for our next duty station when we relocate. And do we want to go to this duty station that's in a place that is known for not being welcoming and friendly to people of color, or do we want to go to this other duty station? So the experience of being a military family of color impacts how their military service and the decisions that they make around their military life, and that has long-standing implications.
With everything that you've explained, how do military families feel about their quality of life? And how do you work to address the gaps there?
As the spouses who started Blue Star Families noted, we love the ability to serve. We love serving the country. We love being part of this community of people that help each other out, that are part of this military community. But there's got to be ways to make some of these things easier. There's got to be ways to improve access to childcare so spouses can work, access to remote jobs that you can take with you from one place to another, improve the ability to obtain housing at your next duty station so you're not waiting for months for a house to open up or to find something that will fit within your family's budget. So most people are really satisfied with military life, but there are some things that we can address and we can fix. And so Blue Star Families looks to do that through our programming and through some of our policy work. So our programming, we have chapters on the ground in different locations across the country. And we are gaining chapters all the time. While trying to gain chapters all the time, we're adding new chapters, two new ones, I think, this year, and with plans for more. The goal is to be in every state so that we can help build those bridges between military families and the communities in which they live. So we're addressing it through programming on the ground, our chapters, building belonging, which we know is a critical component of resilience and being able to bounce back from the stressors of military life, and through our virtual programming. So we have Blue Star Books, we have Blue Star Outdoors, we have museum programs, we have all kinds of fun giveaways for our Blue Star Families members to try and make military life a little bit more fun, a little bit better, a little bit more amenable. That's not the right word, but you know what I mean.
Jessica, I understand that among the new chapters being opened, there is now going to be a Blue Star Families chapter here in Utah. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what they're doing?
Yeah, we have a wonderful chapter in Utah that is focused around, they have a lot of National Guard and Reserve, as well as a few active duty, a lot of veterans there. But they're, the chapter director, Emily, is consistently working on building events and creating connections in the community there. So She's actually been there for a little bit, but it's continuing to build. Utah is only one of our we have 13 chapters now.
We're happy to be included.
So tell us a little bit about what programs that you're going to be, what are your sort of objectives for this year that's new? What are you doing that's different as a priority?
One of our objectives for this year is making military life fun. We want to address the problems. We want to address the things that we can fix, like the house, like bringing the basic allowance for housing stipend back up to 100%, addressing the issue of military family food insecurity, looking at childcare issues, looking at spouse employment. We want to address all of that, but we don't want to just focus on the problems, right? We want to also make military life fun. So we're doing giveaways. We're running our programming like Blue Star Parks and many of our other programs to try and make life a little bit more awesome.
An organization like yours takes not only the energy of people like you, it takes money. Where's it coming from?
So we have a number of wonderful partners and sponsors that help us continue to do this work that is so important. I can't name all of them because we have so many, but one of the ones that is closest to my heart, because they sponsor the Military Family Lifestyle Survey, which is one of my primary projects year after year, is USAA. We also have CSX. They help fund some of those chapters on the ground. I feel bad because I know I'm going to miss a bunch of them, but those are the two that come to mind.
So we start with corporate sponsorship. I would assume you're also getting significant support from individual donors.
We're working on building that. What we try to do is make sure that any of the programs and perks that we have to offer our military families are offered free of charge. And we have a number of really great perks, like Headspace for one. It's a meditation app. We offer that free of charge for our membership. We offer applications like Spiritune, which is a sort of a music therapy stress reliever app that you can have access to. I encourage you, if you are a military affiliated, to go check out what we have available in our Blue Star Perks, because we're always adding new things all the time. So part of it is through partnerships like that. Part of it is through corporate funders. Part of it is through grant work that we do, and continuing to try and build those individual funders so that we can continue to make sure that whatever we have to offer our families is offered free of charge.
One of the areas that you're focusing on that you mentioned was legislation change. Are you keeping track of this? And is there a place on your website where those that want to reach out to their representatives to follow what you're doing and what you support?
Well, we certainly have policy priorities that are listed on our website. And so we have areas that we want to focus. So military life impacts your whole life. The lifestyle impacts everything. So there are so many different things that we could focus on that we have data on that we want to change, but we have to focus our policy priorities on the things that will make the biggest difference and that disproportionately impact military families. So that BAH is one of them. The childcare issue is an issue for everybody, but it uniquely impacts military families, because if you have to wait on a wait list for childcare at duty station A, you wait your 6 months, you get your kid into childcare, and then you move to duty station B and you wait 6 months there. So it uniquely impacts military families. That's what we want to focus on.
Let me ask before we go, I just want to ask, how has the Department of Defense and the Department of Veterans Affairs, have you had a positive relationship on your interactions with the executive agencies?
Well, yeah, I think they one of the things is they know that we are working to support military families, and they know the importance of military families. Recently, the DOD just shared their plan for addressing equity. And for the first time, they included military families in that plan. They have previously looked at service members, which is great. It's a good start. But what we have noticed from what we have done, looked at from our work on the Campaign for Inclusion, is that military families are of color are often overlooked. So this, for the first time, has been included there. So we are continuing to inform the policymakers, both in DOD and VA and in Congress. And my colleague just testified to Congress a couple of weeks ago. So we're continuing to inform these legislative priorities for not just Congress, and not just legislation, but also for states and DOD and VA and even local communities.
We've enjoyed speaking with you. I'd love to have you tell our listeners where they can find out more, because I know there are some that may not be involved with the military but would like to support this cause.
Absolutely. So if you would go to bluestarfam.org, that's our website. You'll be able to find about, you'll be able to read about our research. You'll be able to read about our programs and what we have available, what the perks are that we have, what our policy priorities are. So that's bluestarfam.org.
And we'll include links to the other sites that you've referenced as well. We really appreciate the time you've spent with us. We've been speaking with Jessica Strong of Blue Star Families. Jessica, thank you for spending time with Mountain Money.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Today, May 30th at 10 a.m., there'll be a Memorial Day service at the Park City Cemetery. The event will have the Troublemakers singing before the ceremony and opening with the national anthem. The Summit County Sheriff's Office will provide the color guard and will have a riderless horse to remember fallen service members. Nan Worrell is the speaker for the service. Again, this event begins today, Memorial Day, at 10 a.m. at the Park City Cemetery.
Money, 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 money. I'm Doug Wells.
Hi, I'm Roger Goldman. Welcome to Mountain Money.
In 2014, NRA Executive Vice President Wayne LaPierre wrote, "For any American who is worried about this country, who feels our core values slipping away, who believes something has to be done to change the direction of our nation before all is lost, the NRA is your refuge. It is your place to stand and fight with Americans just like you for all that is good and right." The NRA held itself out as a not-for-profit dedicated to the idealistic efforts to educate Americans on gun safety and the protectors of Second Amendment rights. It was politically powerful and a feared entity with millions of dedicated and vocal members.
But in January 2021, facing investigations at the state and federal level, the National Rifle Association filed for bankruptcy. The bankruptcy trial was ugly. Former NRA board member Philip Journey testified that he viewed the NRA as essentially operating as a kingdom rather than a corporation, Wayne's kingdom. The trial revealed a complex web of financial dealings unrelated to any of the issues the NRA stood for. So how did the NRA become Wayne LaPierre's world? What were some of the financial abuses that have emerged, and how did this fundamentally American institution become entangled with Russia? We're lucky this morning to be joined by Tim Mack, who not only covered the NRA story for NPR, but wrote about it in his new book, Misfire, Inside the Downfall of the NRA. Good morning, Tim, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Tim, let's start with a little bit of background about the NRA. Tell us a little bit about its history and how did its mission sort of change over time?
Sure. Well, the history is quite long, and it stretches all the way back to the aftermath of the Civil War. Back then, there was a debate among military officers about whether to teach individual soldiers individual marksmanship. There was a worry among some people. The prevailing military wisdom of the time, actually, was that teaching individual soldiers how to shoot precisely would actually encourage inappropriate individualism in the troops. But, some military officers dissented, and those officers ended up forming the National Rifle Association, actually in New York State. And that's going to be a fact that is important later. Over the 20th century, it's an organization focused on gun safety, education, outdoorsmanship. And in fact, into the 70s, the NRA was an organization that really seriously debated moving away from the Second Amendment and gun rights as an issue and focusing on outdoor sports and education, moving all the way out to Colorado. So this was something that was hotly debated and contested, ends up being a real kind of civil war inside the organization. And Second Amendment activists end up winning that battle. For the future of the NRA. And it becomes a much more political, much more activist organization than it had been in the past. It's the kind of the NRA that you know today stems from about 40 years ago when it became much more politically active. And, you know, there's more to that trajectory, but that's kind of a good start as to the history.
That is a good start. Another good start for our audience would be to give us some background about its leader, Wayne LaPierre. How did he come to power? And how was his public image different than how he was really running things on the inside?
Well, you know, Wayne LaPierre is an individual who started off as the head of the NRA now some 30 years ago. And, you know, he has a public image of being this firebrand. He gives these speeches where he talks about the NRA as, you know, the last refuge for freedom in America or similar types of comments. But privately, he's an intensely anxious individual, someone that's very deeply concerned and self-involved with his own personal safety, not very bold, actually quite someone who's easily irritated, easily scared, and very someone who doesn't make hard decisions easily without being pressed, someone who's easily bullied into doing what other people want. And so over the last 30 years or so, Wayne LaPierre has been able to amass a lot of power inside the NRA, mainly because powerful people in and around NRA circles have learned that in order to get what they wanted, all they had to do was yell at Wayne LaPierre enough, shout long enough, demand something strenuously enough, and they'd eventually get what they wanted. And that's something that has led to a lot of corruption at the highest levels of the NRA, whether that's tens of millions of dollars in sweetheart contracts for those in the know, or millions of dollars worth of golden parachutes for former executives.
That sort of is an interesting transition for us. Let's talk a little bit about some of the financial elements that come out in the book about how did the NRA operate and how did Wayne LaPierre and his wife sort of take advantage of sort of the financial resources of the NRA over time?
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about really lavish spending here at the top of the organization. I mean, there are two sides to this organization. There are folks who are just working for a nonprofit and they're making nonprofit wages. They're making just bare bone wages to do the basics of what you imagine the organization is: gun safety, education, that sort of stuff. And then at the top end, at the executive end, you have millions of dollars worth of private jet travel and lavish meals and expensive trips to Europe and the Bahamas. You've got six figures in Italian menswear from a boutique on Rodeo Drive for Wayne LaPierre. The spending really got out of control and was hidden from even senior staff and those in the know, and in particular, the board of directors of the NRA, who either didn't know or didn't want to know.
Yeah, that let me just follow up on that for a minute, because in a normal nonprofit, there are fiduciary responsibilities exerted by a board of directors that is to oversee what professional staff like LaPierre did. Talk a little bit about how the checks and balances within the NRA as a non-for-profit worked, or it sounds like didn't work.
Well, there are two sides to this. There's the willing ignorance of the NRA board, which I can get into, and also the explicit efforts by executives to try to cover their tracks. So let's start with the former first. The board is a pretty unwieldy organization to begin with. For one, it's made of 76 different members. People used to describe the board as kind of like a Politburo. You know, like it would take an immense amount of time to get 76 people to agree on basically anything. And because these responsibilities were so diffuse, very few people found it in their interest to really rock the boat and hold people inside the organization accountable. And secondly, you know, this is a board that's mostly made up of activists and celebrities. If you look inside the backgrounds, the backgrounds, the professional backgrounds of some of these board members, or most of these board members, almost all of these board members, you don't see lawyers or folks with management experience or understanding of accounting or finances. You see folks who are, famous musicians or actors or otherwise famous in the kind of Second Amendment space, not really qualified to provide oversight into an organization that brings in hundreds of millions of dollars a year. So you've got the NRA's board side and why they didn't act as a particularly good check or balance on the spending that kind of got out of control at the NRA. Now, on the NRA executive side, there is a real effort to try to hide the lavish lifestyles that these executives were living. I'll give you one example of how they did it. The NRA executives, including Wayne LaPierre and his wife and other senior officials, loved eating dinner at this Italian restaurant just outside of D.C. called Landini's. Now, Landini's was a place they would rack up thousands of dollars in meals on a pretty regular basis. What they would do is they would take the credit card of the ad agency that worked for the NRA, an ad agency named Ackerman McQueen. They would put the money, the expenses of whether it's meals or private jet travel or whatever, and they charge it to their ad agency. The ad agency would then charge it back to the NRA as a sort of nondescript expense, as if they were just servicing their client as an ad agency. And in this way, they would hide a lot of the things that happened inside the very highest levels of the NRA.
So let's talk about Ackerman McQueen, the ad agency. So it's normal for an ad agency to take their people, their clients, especially a big client like the NRA, out to dinner. It's not normal for their representative to give them their credit card to say, hey, you and your wife go out to dinner. So there's an evolution, right? It's the frog in the hot water. Talk to us about the evolution of that relationship. How did it get to the point where they are giving their credit card to their client and say, hey, go spend the money you want?
Not just credit cards, cash, all sorts of crazy spending. Wayne LaPierre would just call up Ackerman McQueen and say, hey, I need this done. And it could be hundreds of thousands of dollars a month. And Ackerman McQueen would just pay for it and bill back to the NRA in a way that hid the substance of these billings. So this is something that happens over decades. I mean, the Ackerman McQueen NRA relationship stems back, I would say almost 40 years. And this is something that evolves from a normal advertising relationship to one in which the NRA is by far this ad agency's biggest client and makes up a hugely disproportionate proportion of their revenues. And so Ackerman McQueen is doing everything for the NRA, and the NRA is only so happy, led by Wayne LaPierre, is only so happy to let Ackerman McQueen do this as long as it serves as a vehicle to almost launder some of these expenses. This is something that develops over time. The NRA becomes almost symbiotic with Ackerman McQueen. Ackerman McQueen does not only ad stuff, but also communication strategy, crisis strategy, all sorts of things that you'd usually see at a nonprofit inside the organization.
One of the Shakespearean elements of the story is how the relationship between LaPierre and McQueen evolved over time. Talk a little bit about that and how did the force of personality of Mr. McQueen sort of affect what happened?
Well, what is so strange about it is that Angus McQueen, who's the head of Ackerman McQueen, Angus McQueen was a very dominant personality, whereas Wayne LaPierre was a much more passive person. He's a highly anxious individual. And at times, if you talk to folks who spoke to both of these figures, that it would almost seem like Angus McQueen was the boss and Wayne LaPierre was the vendor trying to appease him. For many years, they had a mutually beneficial relationship, though. Angus McQueen got to bill tens of millions of dollars a year to the NRA. Wayne LaPierre got to hide a lot of the impropriety that was occurring at the NRA, and this worked for them. But, you know, the Shakespearean element to it comes in with Angus McQueen's son-in-law, a lawyer by the name of Bill Brewer. And so Bill Brewer gets brought on for a kind of almost fringe case to do some legal representation for the NRA. But over time, he sees an opportunity to expand his business at the expense of his father-in-law. Now, the secret in the NRA has been is that Bill Brewer and Angus McQueen, who are related through marriage, really desperately hate each other's guts and have always resented one another. And Bill Brewer makes a move to try to take out his father-in-law's business. He gradually wins over Wayne LaPierre's respect and trust and begins nudging Angus McQueen and his firm, Ackerman McQueen, out of the NRA. And eventually, it's something that works. And the NRA and Ackerman McQueen get into some very messy litigation. A lot of this corruption begins to start spilling out as a result.
Another interesting story that much of our audience, including mine, before I read your book, talks about the story of the Russian agent, Maria Butina. Talk to us about the relationship there and how that came to light, obviously through your work, and what was the result with the NRA of having this relationship?
So Maria Butina is a Russian citizen who just kind of shows up on the radar in Washington, D.C. In and around 2015, 2016. And it's a very bizarre situation because she introduces herself to a variety of people in a puzzling variety of different ways. To some, she'll say she's a Russian government official. To others, she'll say she's just a student. To others, she'll say, oh, she's a translator. To others, she'll say she's a small business owner. And to others, she'll say she's a Second Amendment activist. Depending on the audience, she's got a variety of different, almost kind of different identities for what she's doing. And this creates a lot of suspicion in Washington, D.C., particularly during the time when it's first being known just how much Russia and the Russian government sought to meddle in the U.S. elections and the U.S. democratic process. And so when I learned about her and I started writing about her, I learned that she had a lot of ties with the National Rifle Association. In fact, later we'll find out that she was acting at the behest of the Russian government in order to try to infiltrate the National Rifle Association. Later on, the Justice Department gets wise to this and ends up arresting her and charging her with being with conspiracy to be an unregistered agent of a foreign government. And she's ultimately convicted and sentenced, serves time, and is deported. What we find is that the NRA sought to help her at every turn. They funded her trips. They funded her travel. They funded her conference attendance. What they did was they really worked to help someone who was acting against the best interests of the United States. And when we think of the NRA, the NRA really does use a lot of patriotic language, but when it comes down to it, when you look into their actions, particularly in this case, they were more than happy to help someone with at the very least unclear motives, and at the worst, a Russian agent.
As the book comes to a close, we learn that Oliver North emerges as the president of the NRA, but he only accepts the job because he's going to get paid by Ackerman McQueen a substantial salary. Later on, the NRA sort of turns that against him. Talk a little bit about that strange sort of litigation posture that sort of leads up to the bankruptcy filing.
Yeah, well, so one of the more climactic moments comes when Oliver North, who folks will remember from the Iran-Contra scandal, Oliver North joins the NRA to be its president. Now, as he's as he's entering the organization, he realizes that something's not quite right, and he starts looking into the finances. He discovers all these legal billings to Bill Brewer. He doesn't understand what they mean. And he's demanding an audit, a financial, independent financial audit of the organization to try to understand where all this money that he's raising is going. And Wayne LaPierre and others are trying to prevent it from happening. This leads to a very kind of dramatic confrontation in 2019, where Oliver North and Wayne LaPierre confront each other in a hotel room right before the annual convention of the NRA, where Donald Trump and Mike Pence are scheduled to speak. Basically, Oliver North is continuing to demand a financial audit, and Wayne LaPierre and his allies end up pushing him out of the organization. But that leads to all sorts of other problems. The very public resignation of Oliver North happens just as the New York Attorney General launches an investigation at the NRA's internal financial processes. And that leads, as you mentioned, to all sorts of other terrible developments for the NRA. It leads to charges by the New York Attorney General that the NRA has spent tens of millions of dollars of inappropriate spending and financial misconduct, and naming in particular Wayne LaPierre and the National Rifle Association as the people responsible for that. That in turn leads the NRA to try to file for bankruptcy to avoid these legal consequences. And a lot of the mess that the NRA finds itself in today is a result from that series of, events.
I'm going to let Roger follow up with you on the bankruptcy to avoid these legal charges. But before we go there, you set the scene of Oliver North and LaPierre just before the annual convention having a heated discussion about doing an audit. And obviously, Oliver North had access to the financial records. How did the Attorney General get tipped off that something might be amiss?
By this point in the timeline, the New York Attorney General was reading the same news stories that anyone else would. I was writing stories. Other reporters were also digging into the NRA. And there was already some hint in the public sphere that something was not right inside this organization, that that millions of dollars were being spent, but where was this money going? Who was it going to, and to whose benefit? This is something that began leaking out in and around that time in 2019. There were whistleblowers quietly talking internally and also to the press, and this caught the attention of the New York Attorney General. You'll remember at the beginning of our conversation, I mentioned, hey, that the founding of the NRA in New York would become relevant later. This is where it becomes relevant, that because it was founded in New York State, the New York Attorney General, through its Charities Bureau, has jurisdiction to oversee the NRA as a nonprofit. And this is where it kind of all ties together. When the New York Attorney General investigates, after an 18-month investigation, it finds a lot of wrongdoing.
Before we go, we've heard a lot of sort of scandalous things today and in the book. What is the status of the current investigation? Is Wayne LaPierre still in power? And how is this movie likely to end?
Well, right now, Wayne LaPierre is still in power. He's holding on for dear life. The New York Attorney General and the NRA, it looks poised to go to trial over these over this attempt by the New York Attorney General to dissolve the NRA in its entirety. That's what the New York Attorney General is seeking, and we may see an update on that this spring. There's a lot going on, but obviously the NRA being shut down, which is a real possibility, could really change the landscape of gun activism in this country.
It certainly could. We have been talking with Tim Mack. He is the author of Misfire, Inside the Downfall of the NRA. Tim, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to Mountain Money today. We'd like to thank those that we were able to interview. Jessica Strong of Blue Star Families. We'd also like to thank Tim Mack, author of Misfire, Inside the Downfall of the NRA. We hope you have a great Memorial Day, Thank you for listening to Mountain Money. You've been listening to KPCW Park City.